Took a tree kick down the canyon on the tee shot of hole 9. No one finer as a whiner than this grumbling guest of mine on the Fish Golf Broadcast.
On this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, we're going to welcome back a former guest and now current guest, Brian Earhart. Brian, what you thinking about?
I love being called the current guest, and because I am. And
yeah, accurate.
Funny label. And I know we talked previously about All-Star Weekend. Just daydreaming a little bit bigger to maybe see what else can be done with that format, with that weekend, and how disc golf can kind of make it their own.
Sure. Yeah. And let's disclaim this real quick. Brian, you are employed by the Pro Tour for media purposes, but you are speaking as Brian Earhart, not as anything else right now.
Yes. And I'm not here to advertise a new format that's in the works. I'm not here to drop any hints about something that I heard through the grapevine. I know nothing of what they're doing with the All-Star Weekend in the future. Just me as a lover of disc golf and a fan of where professional disc golf is trying to go. This is me and Fish trying to hash out some ideas. I have a couple of cool ones after watching the slop fest that was Florida. And actually slop fest, like not just saying it's a sloppy event. It was terrible weather all weekend long and really kind of a cool event regardless.
I am speaking for myself as a media baron of the Fish Golf Broadcast. And you can take from that whatever you want. I am advertising formats. No, I'm not. I have no power in this. So Brian, what is something that you would like to see, whether it's the Pro Tour, the PDGA, or somebody else organizing a pro event that we could get excited about that isn't just singles play?
Yeah, so let's back up before we get to, obviously doubles is the other format that I'm really excited about and I want to see more of.
He picked up on the cue, guys.
I did. But let's back up. Before we went on tour, before we started playing all these giant championship gold level courses, we played B tiers, C tiers, A tiers on some wonderful blue level courses that the local community makes their baby and puts so many hours into. But because championship level golf kind of needs championship level courses most of the time, we don't get to see any of these amazing, you know, maybe older courses with more history being competed on. And I feel like there are so many across the country, the Midwest, in my opinion, especially. I might be biased being from there, but I think of so many amazing blue level courses that I wish we could see the pros go back to and compete on. You know what? I'd love to see someone shoot an 18 under par at one of the iconic courses of the Midwest or East Coast or something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't matter the difficulty of the course. You're still stringing together. Like, I can go play my 1986 home course short to short, and it's sometimes hard for me to get past 14 or 15. Mm-hmm. Like, you're going to make a mistake. You're talking about how gold level courses, it's not just the course design, it's the infrastructure that supports that. Exactly. That we've had to move away from many of the classic iconic courses.
Exactly. And also spectator friendliness, not necessarily great because those courses were designed when spectator friendliness was not necessarily needed. And there's even courses being designed now that are not built around spectators. It's understandable because I don't think you have to design an awesome disc golf course with a tour event in mind.
No, the other 358 days a year, that's a whole lot of space that isn't really being functionally used.
Exactly. I, in the Midwest, I'm thinking of like Delwood. We've had a pro tour event there in the past, but it's a phenomenal blue level course. Camden 2 on the Iowa-Illinois border. West Lake, I think you might have played West Lake at one point. Then you go into Iowa and there's so many cool courses there too. Wildcat Bluff is the one that sticks out to me with some iconic holes and the community loves it. And then you go over to the West Coast, you have Pier Park in Portland, one of the coolest par 54, 55s that I've ever played. I would just kill to see some sort of showcase event where we could somehow, for a weekend, make the infrastructure work.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't know if you get this, but sometimes locals will come up and be like, hey, have you played blank? And I try to hit courses in between stops. And everyone wants to hear good things about their home course. It's inevitable. And it sucks when they say, like, do you think it could host an A tier? And it's like, oh, not even an A tier, bud. I'm so sorry. And, like, it's hard to massage that into, like, I really liked it, but it's just a pleasant play on the way to something.
Yeah. So We'll take that first sentiment before we go into the format that I kind of want to see. I just want to see a really cool, fun challenge of a par 54 or something to where the players can go out there and not be stressed out. I don't need to see an all-star weekend where the players suffer on the course. I want to see some highlights. I want to see some crazy throw-ins, crazy putts. I want to see some aggression on these tee shots. I keep going back to Pier Park. Imagine seeing Dreamcatcher on camera again. I just would kill to see that, and especially in a doubles format, which is kind of what I want to see with all-stars in the future. I want to see someone throw hard down that gap. That's something that I miss seeing. We saw footage of it from years and years ago, but I want to see something like that again. And there's so many courses I think local communities will say, hey, come out here and see Castle Hayne in North Carolina and all those courses.
For sure. And being in, say, downtown Portland or going to SeaTac, places that are actually really accessible to majorly populated areas, that's kind of different than how we've had to gravitate to suburban or rural areas for a lot of our tournaments.
Yeah, you need land. You need a lot of land. We don't have multiple millions of dollars to pour into these courses because we're not expecting multiple millions of dollars to come back to us. So those small communities are amazing for disc golf, and absolutely, I can't take away from them. But let's paint a dreamscape of what this could look like, and we'll let the operations people of the disc golf world figure out the rest. Amazing par 54, scenic, ties together the identity of the region's disc golf culture. And then we make it a doubles format. No singles. There's nothing special to a singles format in All-Star Weekend, except maybe you see the players try lines that they want to practice for the future, like we saw in Brooksville. We saw Anthony Barella try to see if he could go over the top on 17. Mm-hmm. Obviously, not going to see that in the tournament. But I want to see a course where the players can shine, and I want to see a doubles format because we don't see it anymore. We don't see it often anymore. I want 3 days of competition.
Yep.
I want a round of alt shot, I want a round of best shot, and I want a round of worst shot. First off, before we go farther, what order do you think we should play those in?
I think you want to put worst shot in the middle. That's your swing round.
Yeah.
Outside of that, the other two have potential to go hot. So at Worlds, mixed doubles at Worlds, at Pro Worlds, which is not a World Championships, it's not a World Championships. Okay, PDGA, we get it. They do best shot and then alternate shot.
Love it.
And alternate shot is where the most swings happen, because you can get one player who's shredding and one player who's not really on, and you just can't score.
Mm-hmm. I think if I pick now, it would be alt shot first, worst shot second, and then the final day is best shot, where everyone just tries to go as low as they possibly can. Mistake management is a big deal in alt shot and worst shot, and
yeah,
we'll let that happen the first couple of days, and then we'll put on a big show the final day. Paired with that, I want to see it be, I'm still hashing this idea out, I want it to be bring your own partner doubles, at least to some capacity. I don't know whether you give the players a rating limit to where two 10-50 rated players can't pair together or something like that. I don't know. Something like fantasy disc golf. But I want to see the players pair up with their buddies. I want to see the players pair up with who they think strategically could take down the title. I think the players would then maybe get more competitive and feel like they have more of a stake in it when it's them and their buddy against the world, rather than, you know, being paired by your captain or something like that. And maybe it doesn't have to be one of the all-stars that you choose. Say you make the all-stars, you're in the top 12 or top 16 or whatever's chosen, but your friend is 40th ranked in the world and has a really cool play style and has a tour card. Maybe it's open to all tour card holders to be chosen at least as a partner.
Sure. And that's where this format might be best for not an all-star weekend, but just something else in the middle of the year.
Exactly. Yeah, it doesn't have to necessarily be called the All-Star Weekend. It doesn't have to be this East versus West. It could have its own name. I like the Estonian Disc Golf Festival. I love the name of that tournament. It's going to be huge, but calling it something other than like an All-Star Weekend, like you know, basketball or baseball.
Yeah, for sure. Think of the rosterbation that folks would get into. Like all of the fans who look at this and say, "Oh, who's Paul going to team up with?" Mm. Or, man, if Calvin would just partner with Chris Dickerson, like we know they're buddies, they'd just be so solid. Or, you know, Garrett Gerthy finds someone who can kind of cover his weaknesses on the putting green. Yeah. Or, you know, if I'm there, I want to find somebody who's got a big distance forehand because that complements the things that I already do fairly well.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm getting at, because say, you know, me and you are on a team.
Yep.
You make the All-Stars. I have a tour card. You pick me as your partner.
We're going to have fun.
We're going to have fun with it. And I'm already thinking of content that I would make. I'm already thinking of trick shot videos that I'd make to start talking smack to the other teams.
Oh,
especially
yeah.
if you give enough time
right.
to say, hey, team, start here. Personally, I think if you just lean into the doubles format and have it not be just an afterthought, a single day thing, it could be a really, really cool thing for the players to build some more narratives around them. And even the ones with the tour card who get chosen that aren't all-stars, that could be awesome. That could be great for their branding as well, and maybe bringing some more entertainment to the spectators that they wouldn't otherwise see.
Yeah, no doubt. Like, look at the boom in disc golf content across YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, like, you name it. The players who are doing best at marketing themselves are those who can show off their personality.
Yeah.
Everybody on tour has a really good disc golf game, but not everybody has figured out how to show who they are as a person. And not everybody's comfortable doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. If I and my partner have a month to prepare for this,
exactly,
you better believe we're going to make some wrestling hype video.
Exactly. Exactly. Just for the fun of it. Just because. And that, to me, brings back the spirit of why I got into disc golf, and that's just frisbee in mm-hmm. general. Just the fun of doing something with a little veil of satire just for the sake of doing it. And I think if the format changed to something like that, maybe we'd see more of it.
Yeah, yeah. And this needs to be a weekend that is very fun. Like, put this at Whistler's Bend, where all of the players... Okay,
exactly.
So Whistler's Bend is the destination. It's not necessarily the park course that's really accessible for spectators.
Yeah.
Okay, so... But at any rate, you have access to just tubing the rest of the day. Man, that sounds like a great way to spend a week during the middle of the summer grind.
I agree. I agree. And paired with the doubles format, this awesome bring your own partner, which, again, you'd have to hash out in some way, shape, or form, the skills competition I would want to adjust as well. And if you had to take two competitions out of the three we already offer, putting, distance, accuracy, if you had to choose two, what would you take?
Accuracy is just so contrived.
Yes.
And then I don't know. I don't really care for any of them, because like the only way to make putting harder is just to like make weird obstacles for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can do that at my winter brewery putting league.
True. I think if you did like a speed putting format or something mm-hmm. like that, you could maybe make putting a little bit more spectator friendly. Because, I mean, again, some people take 30 seconds to putt every time.
Yeah.
And that's just not very lively, so to speak. But distance I'd take for sure. I think if you could jazz up either distance or putting or accuracy, you just take two skills and then Friday morning before the afternoon tee times for doubles, you do an open registration for all tour card, whether it's a silver card or a tour card, open registration for the distance competition.
Sure.
I'm thinking about Jared Stoll. I'm thinking about a guy that murders the disc who has either a silver card or a tour card, but he's not been on camera in a little bit. He'd for sure go. He'd for sure show up to this event because he wants to showcase his stuff to people. And if I'm a spectator and I buy a ticket to go to All-Stars and I get to watch 50 bombers go out there and try to compete in the qualifiers, that's an awesome morning well mm-hmm. spent. You go get some lunch, come back and watch doubles. Day two, you have the qualifiers for putting in whatever, you know, format you choose for that. And you have the whole morning dedicated to putting. And then maybe while that's happening, someone agrees to do a distance clinic or someone agrees to do a putting clinic. And there's more things to do than just sit and watch the thing itself happen all day. I'm thinking of like a more community outreach as well. Maybe there's a day where players can sign up to go do a course cleanup with the local crew or something like that. Some sort of week that brings that grassroots element back and comes to town and really leaves the place better than what they found it as. And that's kind of what I'm thinking. So then Sunday, final day, the finals of the distance and the finals of the putting are in the same morning because there's less people. and then boom, and then best shot happens in the afternoon and you're done. I think that's a pretty great weekend of disc golf, and hopefully, you know, learning and maybe playing yourself. Maybe there's other things that spectators can sign up for as well.
Yeah, there absolutely is potential for more involvement. Like, again, you're not speaking on behalf of the Pro Tour here.
Just dreaming. I'm just dreaming in my own head.
But like, we're not at the point where people want to go to a disc golf course the way that they want to go to an NFL game.
Yeah.
Because there's tailgating, because there's 4 hours of guaranteed entertainment while you're there. There's a huge, big atmosphere associated with it. And we've figured out the tournament part. We've more or less figured out the media part. I don't know that we disc golfers have figured out how to make the event scale to be super fun for everybody who may or may not have heard of disc golf.
Yeah.
Like, you have to be a diehard to want to go out and just follow a card for 3.5 hours.
What a challenge, too, to take a niche sport like disc golf and make it palatable for someone who doesn't play. I think it can be done, but I definitely think it's a giant obstacle. Just like I wouldn't go watch a cornhole tournament. You know, it's same thing. I think if you play it and you're into competitive cornhole, you're more invested, but I'm not going to sit there and watch cornhole.
Right. But if I dryly tell you, like, what the Waste Management Open is, that you're going to go outside and sit in the same place in who knows exactly what the weather is going to be. It could be like really cold and blustery, or it could be boiling hot. And you're going to watch people that you don't know, and maybe they do things well, but you're only going to see them from very far away. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not fun. But there's the expectation of, like, rowdy boys doing stuff that has, like, amplified the perception of the Waste Management.
Hey, I can do that. I can go be rowdy. They really blew their chances this last year. I don't know if you heard about that, but too many people found out about the rowdiness part. And we'll see what happens to the event in the future. But I know exactly what you're saying. It brought a bunch of people who are terrible at golf and probably play once every other month, maybe less than that, to go party, hang out, take pictures, do the dang thing. And golf is also pretty deeply rooted in our culture. Mm-hmm. You know, regardless of what culture it's rooted in, it's rooted in American culture. And disc golf and flying disc culture in general is still, it's getting close to like feeling a closer part of culture. Maybe in our generation, more and more people know what ultimate disc golf, all that kind of stuff are. But I still don't think it's there yet to where, yeah, like it's, the world championships is like a thing where everybody just goes, oh yeah, the world disc golf championships are here. We're going to go hang out and party for a weekend. Like it's not there yet. But
yeah.
I think just as a fan of disc golf, and when I was a kid wanting something so badly like that to be near my house, I think if you, give them more opportunities to engage themselves, maybe there is a spectator distance championships or something like that. More clinics, more course cleanup, more, you know, community involvement, community engagement. That might be a really awesome celebration of disc golf in the middle of the year. That's my wish list, my final wish list item.
Okay, well, there you have it. Brian's got his ideas for bring your own partner doubles that has a big community element to it.
Pretty much, yeah. Last question for you, Fish. Do you still think the stats from an entire season prior should dictate who makes the All-Stars?
This is a deeper question.
It is.
I think it's fair too.
I me too.
Because if you have it during the same season and you try to allocate your All-Stars at the end of the year, everybody wants to go home after USDGC and Pro Tour Championships. Mm-hmm. Nobody has the energy to try to get it up for one more weekend.
Yeah.
So I think it's fair to have the season opener with that, but it needs to be more fun than,
agreed,
than I think it is right now.
I think the All-Star event should be more heavily weighed on fan voting.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I think especially if you do it middleway through the year and the stats, you know, for only a handful of tournaments get counted, you know, let's let the top four at the time make it, or the top five make it, and then the rest are all voted on by the fans. Mm-hmm. So the people that they want to see are actually in the doubles competition, but it's not to say that, you know, someone might not show up and sign up for distance, and someone might not show up and sign up for whatever. And to entice them to come, my last thought, I love that USDGC distance always sets up that big X of baskets. Maybe you do like a car giveaway, like one of those insured car giveaways to like entice people to want to sign up and do something.
Yeah,
like that.
Absolutely. Or I'm sure you've done, like, there's a CTB, there's a case of beer out there on a long hole at a local tournament or something. Like, why aren't we doing more of that? Where, okay, I can't throw 650. I'm never going to compete in the distance. But if you put something out there at 425,
a prize scattered throughout the field,
that I can dink and dunk at, yeah.
That's hilarious. Wow. Year supply of oatmeal right there.
Absolutely.
Quaker Oats, where are you at?
Just impossibly healthy disc golfers shooting to be regular every morning.
We love it.
I'm Luke Sampson, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I go grocery shopping at Aldi.
I'm Thomas Gilbert, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I'm traveling to the next stop.
You know, I spent all of season one in this very ad break saying that we would never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads. But lately, I've had a change of heart. The integrity of this show absolutely has a price. We're talking lake house money. Private island money. Lake house on a private island money. But until that hypothetical benevolent corporate overlord speaks up, though, this show is entirely supported by your support of me and my sponsors. Fish Stamp Discraft discs are available in-store and online at daddydiscgolf.com, dischub.com, and treemagnets.com, and fishdiscgolf.com when I'm not traveling. You can save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10 at checkout, unless you're a fool who likes spending full price on disc golf bags. And of course, our name is derived from Disc Golf Bra, whose media channels and website you should visit for outstanding New England content. And now, more mutual hostility between Fish and the guest. Okay, Brian, so you have your idea, and I'm sure we could flesh out even more specifics of that or have other alternatives for doubles and other fun formats. I have what would never work.
Okay.
Okay. And I'm telling you ahead of time that it's never going to work because there are so many holes that can be poked in this. I want to run a tournament or have a tournament run where we see what pro is best at playing blind on a course.
Okay.
So imagine, if you will, do you have your imagining cap on?
I do. My eyes are closed.
Okay, good. Imagine, if you will, that we've developed a property that no pro has ever seen before. And it's a championship level disc golf course that has everything. It's got some woods, it's got some open, it's got some out of bounds in places, it's got some blind holes, it's got some turning holes, it's got specific landing zones, it's got big diffuse landing zones. This is everything we would want to see in a championship course. But nobody gets to play practice rounds. And there's no media ahead of time. You get a caddy book the day before where things are well marked. Like, all the trees are shown. There's distance to evident landmarks mm-hmm. in the caddy book. And then you're given your tee time. And let's enhance this and assume that the Pro Tour has rented out a hotel. And all of the players get put in individual rooms, but they don't have their phones. They can't talk to other players. They're basically on information freeze out.
Solitary confinement for one day. Is that what you're saying?
Well, 3 days.
Straight days.
Yep. So assume that they can't watch a live stream. They can't follow a card after they're done. They can't walk through as other players are playing. You can't follow your significant other. Your caddy, if you have one, can't go try to get more information. The only access you have is when you step up to hole number one and you get to look down the fairway, refer back to your caddy book, and then decide what you're going to throw. You get one shot at this.
Wow.
Okay, so yep. So we're playing this, and there's no live scoring. Like, you can input it, but you only know what you and your card are doing. At the end of your round, Brian, you had a great round today. You shot a 58. Well, that's 8 down. Good. and you feel like it was a pretty good round, but you don't know for sure because we don't have standings. Everything about this is blind.
Scores are blind, but you know your tee time the evening before.
Correct. But tee times might be randomized.
Random tee times is the way to go.
It is. And you may or may not be grouped with people who are close to you in scores. Because I want the entire effect of this to be that you go shoot the best round that you can with the information that you have and the skills that you have.
I love that. The holes can be poked, but I know what you're saying, and I love what you're saying. I also am envisioning players whispering to themselves or whispering to the other player what they shot the round before, and a ranger just comes up and arrests them and takes them off the course immediately.
Yeah.
You can't share any information with anybody. Your phones are all tapped. You're done.
The entire objective here is to not let anybody circumvent the blind part. And that to me is the practice rounds are totally legit. Mm-hmm. Like the people who are best prepared are often the ones who shoot the best. And the players who say, wait, I didn't know there was OB there in round three of a tournament. What the fuck are you doing? That baffles me. You're a professional. Mm-hmm. You need to be ready for that. But I think it would be really cool to see who has the skills to just dissect this with what they see and what they know they're capable of doing.
Who is the best blind player that you've played with? Or does anyone stick out to you as someone who can just show up and wreck a course like that? How do you feel like you fare?
I feel like I would do pretty well because I can simplify my game. I don't really get suckered into distance lines unless I've gotten to practice them. So I feel like I can kind of just point and shoot and play to minimize mistakes. Mm-hmm. I know that Garrett Gerthy for the last few years hasn't been doing many practice rounds. Like he might get one full round and then walk the course with putters or something. And he's so solid in like his process and his game that he's able to step up and shoot really good. I know for a while there would be other folks like me who had day jobs but would jet to whatever tournament they could get to on a Thursday night. And you know, you kind of just roll up and it's like, well, I watched last year's footage that we'll just have to make that good enough. Mm-hmm. Somehow I think Ricky Wysocki would do so well.
I agree.
Because he just has a toolbox of shots.
And he doesn't overthink anything. He steps up, fires away, doesn't ever take too long on any shot. I think he would do great.
And he also has the tremendous safety net of putting. Like if there's a deceptive green and he leaves it 50 short, that's still a good percentage make for him.
I refer back to the quote that he gave me at Olympus. He looked at me and he goes, well, yeah, disc golf's hard. I've never played a round of disc golf where there wasn't a struggle. That's like not even a real thing. And it's his real like view of the sport of disc golf. And I feel like you watch a lot of players, even really talented ones, somehow act and you see them acting like the course owes them something or the game owes them something. And it's because they're not believing what Ricky is saying. Like, it's not a thing. Disc golf and golf are hard sports, and struggle is a part of the game. And I think for him, he would just see that as a fun challenge. He wouldn't complain about not seeing the course. He'd show up and just start ripping.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Think how many, like, diverting from the topic of this tournament, think about how many players shoot really good one weekend, and it becomes their expectation that it's always going to feel that breezy.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes you get to find that zone and other times it can leave you for 2 months and you wonder, am I still that player? Yes, you are. But not every break goes your way. And not every, like, sometimes you hit traffic and you only get to the course 35 minutes ahead of time instead of an hour 30. Mm-hmm.
But this time you show up and you have to play disc golf.
Exactly. Like you get to throw into a net and you get to putt and now you're at the tee and what you see is what it is.
Do you have any other ideas that have lots of holes that you can poke in them, but they're very, very creative?
Socialism?
Could be. I wasn't expecting that, but touche. Disc golf related. Socialist disc golf?
I think more collaborative stuff between manufacturers or something.
Ah.
Like, let's talk about another format that people roster bait is about as well. Like, whose squad is the best?
Formula One style.
Exactly. Like, yeah. if we do an event where Discraft and Enova and Discmania and MVP and Castoplast and Latitude and whoever else all get to send their best four men and women, and you get points like it's a cross-country style or something, where first place gets 1 point and the goal is to shoot as low. Mm-hmm. Is that F1 as well?
I think so. I think, you know, it's like Ferrari versus Mercedes versus all those other, you know, car manufacturers. I think it's the same thing. To go a step farther, I would love in a reality that doesn't exist, I would love for like an NBA Live 2006 style franchise draft or a fantasy draft where all contracts are wiped, all players are free agents, and then whatever manufacturers wanted to get into it had to go and draft their players.
Oh, neat.
From scratch. There's a lottery system and everything that happens, and so, then it's a snake draft.
Interesting. So maybe like each team gets a market cap established, mm-hmm. and players are battling for what they're worth or what they think they're worth. But you know, Innova and Discraft get big budgets, but what's a small
Castoplast?
Castoplast is a little more limited in what they can do, so they have to be really shrewd in their investments. Mm-hmm.
Who would go first in MPO? I mean, Kristen would go first in FPO right now, but who's going first in MPO?
I think you draft somebody like Calvin, who's still fairly young, has a really, really high floor, mm-hmm. and has proven that he's capable of winning. Once you kind of get out of the top, the clear consensus, say 5 or 10 in MPO and, you know, 6 or 8 in FPO, then manufacturers need to be drafting players that they can bid on potential rather than performance.
Yes.
Like, free agency in every sport is what you've done, it's based on what you've done, and you're kind of getting compensated for being underpaid on your initial rookie contract.
Exactly. And I'm sure, you know, there'd be some conversation about what someone's about to do, and also you've been through the tour, like, and I've been through the tour, and you know that, like, it's a long, like, grind of a commitment to, like, live on the road and enjoy being on the road full time. And I think that if I'm a team manager, I'm looking at that as well. Does this person like being on the road, or is this person retreating as much as they can and maybe not playing as many tournaments as they should? Maybe they don't like living out of their car, you know, every weekend. But that's another thing that I like to see. I always like to ask players, are you happy living out here? And some of the answers are like, no, it's okay. And some are like, yep, I eat rice and beans every day. I live out of my car. This is great.
They love the van.
That's peak existence. Yeah. They've done it.
And that's awesome.
That's valuable.
But, you know, some folks have a mortgage or have a family or have other stuff that are important to get back to. I've been reading quite a bit about baseball, as I always do. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I read recently was about the evolution of how analytics has changed baseball over the last, say, 15 years or so. And the idea of sabermetrics and analytics isn't so much about just turning everything into a numbers game, but in finding inefficiencies that the market hasn't corrected for.
Interesting.
So that's how a team like the Rays can be very successful, because they tapped into things like spin rates on curveballs before other teams did. And that helped optimize their pitcher development system.
Really?
Uh-huh. And then there are franchises like the Pirates that have been notoriously averse to doing that. And they lag behind. Their major league performance isn't that great. They rarely have prospects that come up and are ready to play. And as a result, they're in a pretty weak division, but not that competitive. Mm-hmm. So one evolution that happened was the minor league system. Minor leagues have long existed in baseball, and it wasn't until Branch Rickey in about the 1940s incorporated various independent teams as part of the Dodger system. So that gave the Dodgers a pipeline to bring talent up, and that's why they were so successful in the 40s and 50s.
Interesting.
But for so long, minor leagues have been a lot like low-level touring disc golf, where you get a low budget. You often have to go for like cheap, calorie-dense foods that might not be that nutritious. There may or may not be a trainer at the field. You're kind of just like in it for the love of the game, and then you have to go find an off-season job to work.
Yeah, true.
So what a couple teams started doing was they might have cut a couple of their levels of teams so that they have fewer total minor leaguers, but they're investing a little bit more in each of them.
I see. And it kind of sounds like what disc golf is doing right now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. I'd like to walk a little further down the baseball path and then pivot into disc golf. So let's say that you've got 120 players in your minor league system, four or five teams worth, and you're banking on five of those players being ready to contribute within the next 2 years. What dollar amount is it worth investing in your entire system to try to squeeze that to 6, 7, 8? If you're able to get somebody on a rookie contract who can contribute as a utility or backup infielder or a relief pitcher so that you don't have to pay a late career veteran to do the same thing, you might be able to save $1.5 million on that one player alone.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Like, that is interesting.
That's a lot of money to you and I.
Yeah.
What would you do with $1.5 million if I gave it to you right now?
Right now? I mean, I would probably save or invest most of it.
Dork.
We're talking about peak existence. I'm sitting in a room with you talking about Frisbees right now, and I'm not at an office. Life is really good right now. I asked James Conrad the same question, and he laughed at me, and he's like, my bus might be just a little bit bigger. I'd probably buy a new car. I'd be touring in a nicer car, and I'd build a sauna at my house and then invest the rest of it.
Okay. Respect.
What about you?
I'd probably pay off student loans.
Yeah. Dork.
Fortunately, it's a five-figure amount, not a seven-figure amount.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's say that a team saves $1.5 million. And they have 120 players in their minor league system, and they've got 30 coaches. So if you upgrade their apartments, if you give them a better stipend for food, if you have a spread of food at the ballpark, if you give them better trainers, you are increasing the chances that every one of those guys is able to level up and improve what they're doing and focus on baseball instead of not being able to call their family.
Basic
later.
Needs, yeah.
Yeah. Right now, manufacturers in disc golf treat players as independent contractors. And that's kind of how it's always been. And in the last, say, 12 years or so, there's been an evolution where many touring players have a stipend, they have access to discs, they have a bonus structure. Like, there are legitimate ways to scrape together a living in addition to tournament winnings and clinics and, you know, working other odd jobs or remote jobs. I wonder if there's an inefficiency that manufacturers have not covered yet, where, and this is true of the Pro Tour as well. This year, the Pro Tour has started introducing some additional player health opportunities through Disc Golf Strong. The Pro Tour has this group of players who are all committed to the tour. What's weird is that we are their product and we are also their clients. I think there could be room for somebody in disc golf to find ways to get a little better out of their players by tailoring their experience a little differently.
Tailoring the sponsorship experience? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. So, like, look at Joe Anderson and Braden Sides. They're in an RV that's owned by Castoplast that Luke Sampson was driving the last couple years. For them, that's home. That's a touring vehicle. That's storage.
The shower.
That it means that those guys, as young players who have a ton of potential, their sponsor is giving them something that might be non-monetary, but it means that they have much simpler logistics than they would if they were in a vehicle and had to get Airbnbs every week.
Yeah, oh, definitely, for so many reasons. And I think there's a lot of things that companies could do. I've thought about, like, there's a lot of basic things, and it's not saying this as a commentary on my experience with Discraft. I think Discraft, you know, did a phenomenal job when I was playing with them, and you're still with them, so something's right about what they're doing. But, you know, you always wonder, like, maybe you could tailor the sponsorship even more to the player and what their needs are, and maybe sometimes playing executive chef a little bit and being like, you're going to eat this food, you're not going to order off the menu. Like, we're going to bake in, you know, one appointment a month with a sports psychologist or something like that to check in with you to see how you're doing, you know, mental health wise, but also athlete wise. Because, you know, sometimes it's hard to truly call yourself or feel like a pro athlete, you know, when you're playing a disc golf or playing disc golf, like a sport you might have played since you were a kid just for fun. And now you have to treat it like this really serious professional sport. So just having someone to check in with you in regards to living on the road full time and structure your practice that makes you feel like you're making progress. Because I feel like sometimes when you're on your own, it's just like you feel like you're going insane.
For sure. Yeah. And that's why it's so critical to have a group of homies on the tour.
Agreed.
That, you know, that you can hang out with, that mm-hmm. you can play practice rounds with, that you can, that who can pull you through the slump.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're not saying that Discraft or other manufacturers mm-hmm. should be doing these things. You ask the question, like, what's something else that holes could be poked in disc golf that is an idea? Well, to me, this seems like a way that the Pro Tour or manufacturers or other sponsors mm-hmm. could increase the performance of their athletes.
Mm-hmm.
But to them, like, they are in the business of making money for their business.
Exactly.
So how do you quantify the net benefit that, say, I give to Discraft or I give to Grip or I give to Disc Golf Bra or other sponsors? Mm-hmm. It's definitely like, how many discs do I sell with my name on them?
Yeah.
But it's also how do my actions on and off the course reflect on my sponsors? Do people have a positive perception of the brands that I'm representing as a result of me?
Is it symbiotic?
Yeah,
exactly. And that's how sustainability and like longevity happens, is the
right.
partnership is clean and happy and everyone is delivering value back and forth to each other. The other thing, the last thing I was thinking of in regards to sponsorship is, say you're a manufacturer, I'm a manufacturer. We see a kid like a Gannon Bird type character who's young, really motivated to get, you know, get good, but also knows that there's a bidding war happening for him in the future. You offer...
We're going to collude.
What?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We could. We'll do a joint deal.
No, we're going to lowball him.
Oh, well, we're all going to tell him that he's only worth $8 an hour when he's on the course.
Think about what he'd be making at Dairy Queen. $8 an hour.
Yeah.
That's what he's worth.
Sorry, kid. No one thinks you're worth it. No. What I'm saying is, you know, say someone offers him, you know, $500,000 a year, but then there's a company that says, hey, we really believe in you and we want you to be the absolute best you can possibly be. You're only 18 years old. Let's try to make you the greatest player who ever lived by 25. We're going to pay you less than $500,000 a year, but we're still going to pay you a lot. And we're going to force you to allocate X amount of dollars to a sports psychologist, to a trainer, to this, and then constantly check in with them. Have someone that is constantly making sure that they're doing their homework and staying on top of it, but also staying happy in the process of doing all those things to be the best they can be. And I think nurturing the athletes is another, you know, frontier that makes players feel good. And I think that's what I've heard from players across the board. It's like, does my team make me feel welcome here?
Sure.
Do they care about me if I'm not number one on the team?
And that's a tough sell to
an
18-year-old who's like, you want to put how much away to stuff that's not actually going to me?
Yeah.
But like LeBron James has played forever mm-hmm. at a high level.
It could come back to you, but that's the sell.
Like, yeah. We shouldn't treat LeBron as like exactly what I'm going to be.
Yeah.
Like, the guy's an outlier.
He might not be a human. Yeah.
You don't look at that and say, well, all I have to do is exactly his training and I'll be LeBron. No, they're like, he's an outlier.
Yeah.
But for years, he's dedicated reportedly $1 million to wellness, yeah. whether that's food or doctor's appointments or
recovery is a big one for him. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you're looking for sponsorship, mm-hmm. it might not be the bottom line dollar amount.
Yeah.
It might be a little more holistic or where your base is a little bit lower with incentives for other stuff.
And I think you could do that with lower level players. I think it doesn't have to be a player you pay six figures to. I think it could be a younger player you pay a solid wage to and then say, hey, for these 3 years, we're going to focus heavily on your wellness and getting you in the habits of being a professional athlete on the road. And then after the 3 years, we can renegotiate and see if we want to pay more money. But again, I don't sponsor players. This is just, you know, dreaming and really things that I thought about when I was on the road playing as well.
Sure. All right. Well, there's a couple ideas, and I know we diverted, but we always seem to. Our conversations are never short, but they're always interesting.
Yep.
So if you have great ideas for doubles or for the blind championships, or you have property, if you have 400 acres and you want me to design a perfect course that can be used in this format, call me. Brian, you are welcome to come by.
Okay.
But you're going to be signing an NDA. You can't tell anybody about it.
Done deal.
How great would your job as interviewer be on like media day for players who haven't seen the course?
How you doing?
So what do you think of hole 16? Don't know.
I know. I'm just messing with you. Yeah. Have a good day. I'll see you on Friday.
Brian, thank you so much. Yeah. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to lavish compliments on me, you can find me on Instagram and whatever the fuck Twitter is at fish58320. If you hated the podcast, thought the guests had only bad ideas and need to yell at somebody about it, Brian, where can people find you?
Brian_Earhart on Instagram. I get it all the time. I look forward to it.
That's a wrap on this week's Fish Golf Broadcast. Join us next week to fritter away more of your ever-waning life force on two jabronis talking about Frisbee. Please support the show, if you're able, by shopping for fish stuff at fishdiscgolf.com, Daddy Disc Golf, Disc Hub, Tree Magnets, and Disc Golf Bras websites. You can still save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10, and please tell a friend about this show. Unless you don't have any friends, but that's your problem, not mine.